covering the business of food. Hey, that's our tagline for Market to Market. But today we're talking with a reporter from the Food and Environment Reporting Network. Hello, I'm Paul Yeager, host of this M2M podcast. Glad to have you here. We are a production of Iowa PBS and the Market to Market TV show. If you wouldn't mind clicking subscribe, so then you can always know what's going on, or tell a friend if you liked an episode or not. So today we're going to be talking about the industrial scale farm and those that cover it. We'll talk to Leah Douglas with Fern News. That's how you'd find the website, thefern.org. And she normally covers that, as I said, the industrial scale farms, and has done that for a number of years. But now she's covering it through the lens of COVID. She has a chart on their website that breaks down the infection rates at meatpacking plants, food processing plants, and farms themselves across the country. We discuss the business of COVID, how safety measures have been taken, and kind of looking forward about how this story moves, and especially when it comes to consolidation of the meat industry. Hope you enjoy this discussion in the weeds on today's M2M podcast. You are in the DC area right now. First off, let's talk about the weather. Is it hot there?
It has been sweltering. Yeah, it feels like we're living inside a hot thunderstorm this week, all week.
I've always heard it described, a summer in DC is like living under an armpit. Is that pretty accurate?
I love the area, but there are days where it does feel like that. I can't deny it.
The forefathers had this summer break correct when they used to take summer recess so they could get out of the area that was hot and heavy. So you are with, if you go to the website, it's The Fern, but it's really the Food and Environment Reporting Network. Tell me what that is.
Sure. So the Food and Environment Reporting Network is an independent nonprofit news organization. We do investigative and explanatory reporting on the food system. So everything from food production, workers in the food system, environmental health impacts. And we partner with regional and national media to bring our stories, hopefully, to folks who aren't always reading consistently about food and farm news. So we're hoping to expand and grow knowledge of the issues in the general public.
You have a media partner, I see, Univision. There's also the donate button. Have you worked outside of the nonprofit media world?
Personally, I've been in nonprofit news for my whole career, but I have a freelance variety of publications. But we have a variety of media partners, several dozen. So our most recent story published yesterday was in partnership with Univision, discussing farm workers in the Salinas and Monterey County, California. But we, depending on the story, we love to partner with regional outlets where the issue we're writing about is of importance to the folks in that area. And we also do national stories as well.
And I guess the reason I ask you your career, just for the sake of giving me a little perspective of how, so if you freelanced, you kind of know how that economic system is, but just the traditional, .com media has been supported by the subscriptions and advertising, where you are not funded by that.
Sure, it's a mix. We do have subscribers. We're also funded by foundations and sort of a mix of different funding streams. Yes.
Okay, that's just one of those. Everybody likes to know. Well, where's the money coming from? You know how it is. Follow the money, right? What are some of the stories that you have covered in your time there?
Sure. So my beat generally has to do with agribusiness. I tend to cover issues related to consolidation in the food and ag sector, the different community impacts of industrial scale farming, some of work on the environmental impacts. This year, we've really focused the vast majority of our efforts on covering the COVID-19 pandemic, like so many newsrooms. And I've undertaken an effort to count and map outbreaks and cases of COVID-19 among food system workers. So that's the biggest project I have going right now. I'm looking at meatpacking workers, food processing workers, and farm workers. How is the pandemic and this virus affecting them?
There is a map that you tweeted out this week that kind of color coordinates between three different types of groups. How are you finding data? Because we know that every state, even county, city agencies are somewhat reporting the same, but different and sorting through. How has that process been for you?
Yep, that's right. It's a little bit it's definitely a varied approach. So the majority of information that I gather for my database comes from local news reports, and those news reports tend to be sourced from local health agencies. So whether that's, you know, the hyperlocal, the county health agency that's doing testing, or the state releasing figures. So that tends to be one big channel where the information is coming from. Some states have begun releasing information to the public more broadly about food sector workers in COVID-19. So in some cases, I'm able to get information directly from the states, and some companies have also begun releasing that information as well. So in some cases, I can get that information directly from the companies with affected workers.
Have you found over the last few months that companies have been more forthright or less forthright with their information about infected workers?
Generally speaking, companies have been reticent to release information about the spread of COVID-19 at their facilities. And one notable exception, Tyson Foods has been undertaking testing efforts at about 40 of its facilities and rolling out that data as it comes in. So that's been a great service because it's not all of their facilities and it's one-time testing, but it does give a lens into how the virus has spread at some of those really massive facilities that Tyson controls. Beyond that, there's a few smaller companies that have been forthcoming about outbreaks among their relatively small workforces, but it has been difficult beyond that to get reliable information from the companies themselves. They tend to not respond to requests for detailed information about outbreaks and cases at their facilities.
And especially now, yeah, they're not really wanting to give. Have you, with Tyson, we know about a month ago, so mid-May, kind of hit a high number and some plants where I guess that was April already. Since that initial surge in infections, have they still been forthright with information, or was it kind of a smaller time that they were as forthright with telling you what's going on?
Well, Tyson, it's been changing over time a little bit. At the very beginning of the pandemic, they were not releasing information. Their testing effort, I believe, began in May, although I'm not 100% positive. So, you know, on their website, they now have information from the facilities where they have done testing, and there's a timestamp. So maybe over a course of 2 or 3 days, the testing takes place, the results are processed and then released. So there's a little bit of a time delay there. So that's continuing, although there's no indication that beyond that one-time testing at those 40 facilities, the company will retest or demonstrate, you know, help us to understand whether there's trends, are the cases falling, rising, expanding that testing pool beyond that handful of facilities. So there's still a lot that's unknown there.
We are talking on July 8th. 2020, as we have this conversation, just for a date stamp of things, we know that we know that the number of infected people in the United States has now topped 3 million out, not just in food, but just everywhere. We know that there's been positive cases in these meatpacking plants where some have closed. Do we think, like in some parts of the United States where we've seen either a continuation of a surge or infection rate, that we're going to see a return to higher numbers at meatpacking plants, food processing plants, farms, and ranches? Do we think that there was a infection round one, and we think we're going to have a same round again in some of these places?
You know, it's a great question, and that's really the question that so many of us are spending our time looking at right now, trying to figure out, what trends are we seeing? What patterns are we seeing? From my analysis, there's been a pretty consistent rise in the number of cases over time. There hasn't been really a significant leveling off beyond for a couple of days across any of the sectors I'm looking at, whether that's meatpacking, food processing, and farm workers. So we're seeing a pretty consistent trend line there. Certainly in the case of farm workers, there's a lot of concern right now as the harvest season gets underway, as migrant workers are traveling throughout the country, that we're going to see cases continuing to pick up in that sector. And, you know, just anecdotally and through my research, in the beginning of the pandemic, March, April, we weren't seeing a ton of cases in the farm worker sector simply because there weren't as many workers on the ground. It was not the harvest season in most places. Now, as we go into late summer, there are rising cases in that sector, and wouldn't be surprising if, unfortunately, the number of cases continues to grow there.
Anecdotally, the stories that we heard in the very beginning, Florida, California, and some of those areas, the crop that was destined to be picked, put on a cruise ship, or put in an entertainment venue, caused a problem with all this extra product with nowhere to go. That is a story that's likely going to be repeated here as other crops come into ripening or ready for market. Is that a fair statement?
You know, it's a great question. We definitely saw major upheaval at the beginning of the pandemic as basically, you know, the 50% of our food that's funneled into institutional settings, whether entertainment venues, like you say, or healthcare facilities, or schools, universities, things like that, hotels, where because of the lockdown, there was a huge issue getting that food redistributed to the retail market, to grocery stores, where more and more people, we are predominantly spending our money at the grocery store right now. For the most part, my understanding is that those logistical hurdles have been figured out in most places, and I haven't heard that necessarily we'll see a resurgence of those issues, although it continues to be an obstacle for growers, for producers, to continue to find the right market for their products. So it's definitely fair to say that it continues to be, you know, it's not business as usual, I'll say that much.
I'm not sure if we ever know what business as usual or was usual, if we get to that in any quick time frame. Mm-hmm. That's going to be quite the thing to watch. Now, I know that labor was an issue early on when borders were shut down, both north and south of the United States. We're not letting in seasonal workers. And then there was quickly an exemption put in for that. Do we know if, I don't know if the time frame of that was going to run out, that we're not going to have seasonal workers be able to come into the United States? Do you know anything about that?
As far as I know, you know, H-2A workers, which are the workers who come into the United States on the H-2A visa to do agricultural labor, which represents a significant portion of the agricultural workforce during the harvest season, those workers are still entering into the country. Restrictions from the Trump administration on specific visas do not apply to agricultural workers. So there was, as you said, some upheaval and confusion about that at the beginning of the pandemic, some concern that with borders closing, we wouldn't have those migrant workers able to come here and work. However, for the most part, as I've heard as of now in July, there has not been an issue getting those workers here.
But now the issue is going to be keeping them healthy.
Absolutely.
And you read the stories of the meatpacking plant workers where there might be two or three generations living in the same house that's maybe three rooms or four rooms, trying to isolate someone that may have become sick or prevent somebody from being sick. That is not just isolated to meatpacking. It's kind of the same in the farm and ranch worker area as well. Is that right?
That's right. And it's, you know, for farm workers, one of the major, you know, some folks, when I've talked about this issue, say, well, farm workers are working outside. And don't we know that, you know, transmission is more difficult outside? Well, it's not necessarily the field work that exposes workers to contracting the virus. It's as much their housing facilities, their transportation facilities, their lunchrooms, lack of access to sanitation, regular hand washing stations, and so on. Those are the types of factors that can make it a very difficult environment to keep yourself protected from COVID-19.
I like infrastructure. I like logistics on how some things work, products making into. Let's shift a little bit to the food processing plants. They face, again, the same things that you've talked about, break rooms and sanitary conditions and products coming in. But again, what's the, are they in the middle of Is it more manageable at some of these food processing plants than maybe it can be at meatpacking and farm and ranches?
Well, it's a great question. And if by my definition, food processing really contains multitudes. That in my data set describes everything from a next stage meat processing facility that's maybe taking a whole half an animal and turning it into a sausage, for instance, well, several sausages, or any, you know, a produce salad, you know, production company or facility, or frozen foods, berries or fruit processing. That's another huge sector. So what it looks like in each of these facilities is very different. Obviously, all those different, different fields that I just described involve different amounts of different types of labor. So some of those facilities can be quite small, you know, and smaller facilities can, you know, be a little more agile in responding at times. But it really, because of the wide range, it's hard to generalize.
And we then know the way agriculture works, you can't really spread out the time frame that a crop is ripe and comes into the plant. You might be able to say, instead of two shifts, we're going to do three, but now we have no time for cleaning or trying to keep an area set up, but we might not have enough workers for all those shifts, or we already were running three shifts. We don't have enough hours in the day. But also the cost of this for these companies. I mean, there's so many factors that a food processing or meatpacking plant are having to deal with.
That's right. And definitely the timing has been a major issue. You know, just for one example, one aspect of the ripple effects of the pandemic, you know, in the meat sector, in April and May, we saw a number of facility closures, which really reduced the processing capacity across the country for whole animals. And those animals ended up on the farm because there was nowhere to go. And the expense to farmers to continue feeding those animals was high and in some cases prohibitive on the one hand. And additionally, you know, those animals are, if they stay long enough, go sort of beyond their peak, the right moment to slaughter them. So that has led to some what's euphemistically called depopulation, which essentially describes killing the animals on the farm instead of at the processing facility, which has created its whole own set of logistical and financial, you know, burdens for growers and for producers, for ranchers. So there's many different ways in which these disruptions at the plant can create ripple effects back down the supply chain.
Well, and that's something we cover. Our audience is very aware of. What do I do with these 1,200 piglets that have come? What, you know, I might be able to find people this time, but well, the next time, well, hogs are ready to go to the market when they're ready to go. They just can't go slowed down on their rations too much more than a week or two, just because of the finite science. The cattle market has a little bit of a problem, but then all of a sudden you talk about, yeah, go back, hang out in the grass pasture. Well, it's dry in certain areas where we have a lot of cattle, or we don't have access to those spots. So yeah, it's a serious thing that, and then when the animal becomes heavier, it's not as desirable by the packer. What about packer margins? How much do you ever kind of look at that pre-COVID? Did you pay attention to and understanding the packer margin and people trying to still make money?
Yeah, it's a great question. So definitely before COVID, as I said, my focus tends to be on agribusiness and issues in the sector. And so looking at the biggest meatpacking companies and how the market is structured, how the sector makes money for certain players and presents challenges for other players, was a big part of my reporting. In the pandemic, it's been interesting. It's opened up some new discussion. There's been some allegations that, for instance, in the cattle sector, the packers have, kept prices artificially high and have been making money off of some of these disruptions we've talked about, various logistical disruptions in the supply chain. And there's been there's an investigation ongoing from the Department of Justice into those allegations. So the packers have definitely been subject to a fair amount of scrutiny. They were before the pandemic, but specifically their behavior during the pandemic as well has been subject to some of those allegations.
I think this is me personally, and I've said it in our meeting, our editorial meetings for the show. I think the meat story becomes one of the longest lasting of the COVID, at least in terms of heightening concentration among four large companies. And is that a fair statement?
Well, there definitely has been discussion that the pandemic, first of all, has certainly enlightened many people to just how consolidated this sector is, you know, especially when we had the plant closures. You know, many people in the country are realizing for the first time that the closure of one, two, or three facilities would have such a dramatic impact on even their own ability to get meat at the grocery store. I don't think that was something that, you know, despite many efforts to communicate over the years, that really folks had quite understood in many cases. So there's been some rising awareness of how consolidated it is. And I think there's many people who work on these issues who would like to see the pandemic as an opportunity to change and reform some of these structural issues, whether it's the few, as you say, four companies that in many cases control so much of each sector, or whether the working conditions that, you know, workers in these plants were already experiencing before the pandemic made those conditions, you know, even more difficult. So, you know, there's a lot of discussion about, you know, is there an opportunity here to change some of these structural concerns?
It's still about money, though. It's still about making money for everyone. And efficiencies, food is no different than any other factory in the United States. It's or around the world for that matter. It's still about efficiency at the end of the day. I know that Senator Grassley of Iowa has teamed up with another senator on spot market pricing. That is good and all. It's highlighting a beef industry that still has some spot markets and non-contracted feeders and operations, but that's not the same in poultry. It's not the same in the hog industry. Those ships, apparently, the way this virus has highlighted, has sailed. I'm not sure if anybody is really anxious to look into some of those, but we'll see how those investigations go. Going forward, do you see, when is the greatest challenge now in the food sector? Is it in the next month? Is it in the next 6 months? Is it in the next 3 years?
Hello?
Hello? There you mm-hmm. go. Do you hear me now?
Nope.
Oh, you don't hear me. I am Hello. Here. I am here, Leah. Can you hear me? We seem to have lost connection. Hello.
Oh, can you hear me now?
Now I hear you. Do you hear
okay.
me?
Sorry about that. I think I had an internet issue. No.
What's that?
I think I had an internet issue, but I can hear you again now if you can hear me.
Okay. All right. I'll pick back up my rambling question. I was talking about consolidation in the hog and poultry industry. Is that
great?
We've seen high consolidation in the poultry and the hog industry. Do we think anything's going to change because of COVID and the concentration in terms of contracting? I know you talked about some of the hearings and the investigations, but do we see any of that changing because of COVID?
It's a great question. And, you know, and to some extent, COVID has shined a light on, you know, the whole food system structural issues and many of these real, you know, fragilities that have been facilitated by consolidation in the sector. At the same time, the contracting model itself, for instance, hasn't necessarily been the place where there's a whole lot of public attention in this moment. So again, you know, I think that there are folks who would love to see this be an opportunity for that. I think there are some legislators working on policies that would do, you know, would involve comprehensive food system reform, including those things. Of course, in this political moment, passing any type of sweeping legislation like that is very difficult to imagine occurring, especially during this emergency, public health emergency. So I think, you know, it remains to be seen. Journalists don't like to predict anything because, you know, we like to report it as it happens. But as of this moment, there's not, I wouldn't say there's a lot of conversation happening around the contract model specifically.
Yeah, and that's just one of those things. I've heard economists say this is the only thing they're going to study the rest of their careers. And it's very possible that it's the only thing we report on for the rest of our careers, no matter how long or short they are, just because of the ramifications on so many parts of our lives. But that's just a, that's not really a very big, bold prediction. That's just a weird thing. When do you see, Leah, the biggest time frame of impact on the food system, strain on the food system? Next month, next 6 months, next 3 years? I mean, what's a timeline of when it's going to be the most happening and the most susceptible to the virus?
Oh, it's a great question. You know, it's so difficult to know. I think, you know, one thing I've been trying to emphasize to folks is the food system and its workers are just as much subject to the trends that we're seeing nationally as any one of us. You know, these are communities where the infection rates may be higher, particularly in communities where there are meatpacking plants with outbreaks and so on. But as we're seeing cases rise all over the country, I would be surprised if cases in the food sector didn't rise as well, simply because, you know, we're all part of the same community. So I would say there's, you know, I'm concerned personally about the growth of cases over the last several weeks and how that could affect, you know, specifically food system workers. You know, as I said, again, with the summer underway and the harvest continuing, I think, you know, keeping a close eye on the farm agricultural labor sector will be important. I think there's much more news to come there, unfortunately. So those are the specific trends I'm watching.
Any interest in going into the, have you been inside any of the meatpacking or food processing plants to see firsthand? Have they been, I haven't seen any reporters. I only see issued photos, official issued photos from organization or companies about what's going on inside of any of those facilities. Have you been in any of them?
Unfortunately, no, I haven't had the opportunity. You know, we at Fern, we're all working remotely for the time being from our homes. So not recently, although, you know, there have been some local papers that have been able to get inside the facilities. And, you know, I hugely rely on those local news sources as they're the folks on the ground and can tell the story best. So there is some resource out there. But personally, you know, I haven't been able to be inside any of those facilities myself.
Leah, I forgot to ask at the very beginning, where are you from originally?
I grew up in New York City.
And so how does someone from the city end up covering food like this?
It's a great question, one I get often. You know, my answer's changed over the years. I think it's just an issue that really captured my attention, and I care about it a lot. So, you know, I've stuck with it for a long time, and now it's my biggest passion.
I think there's always a concern from those who see cornrows in the field that look at the rows of tall buildings and go, they don't understand anything about food. Is that a fair overgeneralization of the two regions?
that's a funny question. You know, I think for me, it's something I always try to be very mindful of. And I, you know, I'm very humble in how I approach all of my work, because I know I'm not from a community that necessarily, I didn't learn the ins and outs of farming growing up. I'm really indebted to all of my sources and farmer pals who have taken me under their wing over the years and shown me the ropes where, when I didn't know the difference between various types of, I couldn't tell a, you know, corn stalk from a cucumber. So I'm very grateful for that.
Play a flashcard game with them sometime and just say, which one's this? Which one's this? Which one's this? See how they do. But, you know, did this virus, though, heighten some of those concerns that, I wouldn't say concerns, but heightened, I think you kind of talk about it there, about the awareness of people. Because we've seen the videos of the kids who, that's their families only were getting takeout or for forever. That's all they did. They didn't necessarily know where food came from. Do we think we all have a better sense of where our food comes from after this?
You know, I certainly hope so. And I certainly hope with my work, you know, by persevering to continue to report on the stories of, you know, the conditions that workers are facing, that it will open a door for more people to engage with and understand our food production system beyond just, you know, as themselves consumers, you know, but also to see it as a system that has a real human impact, a real environmental impact, a real impact on the rural communities where these plants are located, and just try to understand the context a little better So I'm really hoping that, you know, if there's that all this, you know, reporting and awareness can have some of that impact. And I do think, you know, even just anecdotally, I do think that people are paying more attention now than they ever have.
And let's hope that they continue to do so going forward, just because so many of us in the United States take for granted where that food comes from. We, even in the middle of corn country and soybeans and cattle here, there are still people who go to the grocery stores I go to that probably don't have a real good idea of where that food truly comes from. And so we all have... both of our lines of work and our outlets, I think, still have jobs to do to inform people about some of those conditions and the challenges that all of these organizations are going through as they try to feed us.
And we'll keep chipping away at it.
One story at a time, right?
Exactly. Exactly. That's the motto.
All right, Leah, thank you so very much for your time. And I look forward to continue following your work and the rest of the folks there at the Food and Environment Reporting Network.
Thanks so much, Paul. Appreciate it.
If you have any questions, comments, or concerns, hit us up at market2market, it's all one word, at iowapbs.org. I'm Paul Yeager. Thank you so very much for listening.